Hi, everyone. This is Brooke James. Thank you for tuning into The Grief Coach. If it is your first time listening, I'm so glad you're here. And if you've listened before, welcome back. Today, I am so excited. We have with us Steve Leader. Steve is the senior rabbi at the Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, and he is author of four books, and his fourth book, The Beauty of What Remains, is what we're going to be talking about today. Thank you for being here.
It's an honor to be with you, Brooke. I'm really happy to be talking with you today.
Yes, I'm so excited you're here. So let's get straight into it. If you can give the audience a little bit of background as to who you are, introduce yourself, and tell us what your grief story is.
Well, as you said, my name is Steve Leader. I have been the senior rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple for about 15 years, and I've spent 33 years there. I started out as the fourth rabbi and worked my way up. It's a very large congregation, about 2,700 families, about 10,000 people.
Wow.
That I'm ultimately responsible for. And obviously that involves seeing a lot of grief, a lot of loss, a lot of suffering. Mm-hmm. And of course, many, many beautiful things as well. But I suspect there's not a rabbi in the country who has dealt with this order of magnitude of death. Mm-hmm. That would rival what I've been privileged and challenged to manage in my career. And I think what is probably the interesting dynamic that we're going to ultimately get involved in our conversation is, where does that experience as a rabbi inform my experience just as a son, as a husband, as a father, as a brother, and as a friend? And, you know, where do they diverge? That's pretty much my story. I've really had one job and one career my entire adult life. I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Minnesota in a suburb of Minneapolis. I'm one of five kids. My dad and uncle owned a junkyard, so I kind of grew up in a working class blue collar family. Mm-hmm. I'm the only one who left Minneapolis and moved to Los Angeles. All four of my siblings are in Minneapolis, where thankfully I am not.
Yeah, it's cold there.
It's really cold there.
Yeah.
That's my story. I've had, as one of my friends puts it, he said, Steve, you have a front seat to life. And that's really my job. I sit in that front seat to life. Yeah.
So how did your work as a rabbi prepare you for loss? We started talking because of the book that we'll talk about more in a little bit, but you experienced a loss. And so was there anything that your work as a rabbi helped you with in processing that?
Well, yes. So the loss you're referring to is my father died after a 10-year battle with Alzheimer's and everything that that implies. There were many ways in which being a rabbi prepared me for the aspects of death and grief that require technical ability, shall we say. Mm-hmm. I went with my mother to meet with the funeral, the cemetery and mortuary, and I knew exactly the questions and the answers that needed to be addressed. I knew how to kind of pull my family together and have a conversation about my father after he died that would enable each of us who were going to memorialize him to do so. You know, I was skilled in the craft of clergy and death. So in that sense, but only in that sense,
right,
did my profession prepare me. The ways in which I was unprepared and ill-informed and ill-equipped, frankly, are the more interesting story and ultimately what's behind the book, where I had to learn on this journey how to become the son rather than the rabbi. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, the rabbi was the default setting. And there was so much about death and grief that Steve Leader, the rabbi, didn't understand until he grieved as Steve Leader, the son.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that so interesting? I think that, like, two things. One, kind of a blessing that you did have that experience that you could bring, because a lot of us, when we go through a loss, we don't know what to ask at the mortuary or the cemetery. We don't know how any of that works. And it's really, I'm trying to pick the right word, but like uncomfortable, to do that. And you're like, I can't believe I'm picking out a gravestone. I can't believe I'm, but you kind of knew that part. But yeah,
That's right. And Graham Greene, the writer, Graham Greene said that the difference between a writer and everyone else is that when the writer is having an experience, even a very negative, terrible experience, or witnessing the pain and suffering of another, this is such a great line, the writer has a sliver of ice in him that allows him to take notes. So my experience as a rabbi was that sliver of ice within me that enabled me to manage the details of death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the emotion.
The emotional part of being the son, there was no sliver of ice at all.
And I think it's something, no matter how prepared you think you are for a loss, if you know it's coming, expected, whatever it is, once it actually happens, you're transformed. And also people who've listened to the podcast have heard me talk about this, but you think you're really empathetic until it happens to you and you're like, oh, maybe I didn't get it.
Well,
like,
Brooke, that is really why I wrote this book, because the book is actually my apology. The book is my apology to my community and to the larger community of grief, of mourners and grievers. It is my apology because as I say in the prologue, I literally have buried 1,000 people. That's not hyperbolic. That's just the fact, right? I have officiated at more than 1,000 funerals. And before my dad died, I was doing that for 30 years. And you know, I would have given myself a pretty high grade. I would say I was doing A or A minus work in helping people through this process. Mm-hmm. What I learned after my own father died was that it wasn't A or A minus, that everything I had been saying, or almost everything I had been saying and doing, was just one degree shy of the deepest truth. It was just a little bit off.
Yeah.
And this book really was my attempt to bring everyone to that final, last degree of the deepest truth that death comes to teach us about life. So yeah, the whole book is essentially a setting of the record straight.
I'm really excited to read it. Your publisher sent me a copy. For those of you who follow the podcast on Instagram, I will post more information about that also and put it in the show notes. If we can talk a little bit about how your loss, for those who haven't gotten a chance to read the book yet, how your loss informed how you dealt with mourning as a rabbi, because did anything change? What changed?
Yes. It's a great question. Well, I'll tell you some of the things that have changed. I used to think of grief as a more linear process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as something that is terrible at first, and then it just progressively improves until it's something that you can really live with very comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned through my own grief, as I say in the book, anyone who thinks the shortest distance between two points is a straight line doesn't understand grief. It is nonlinear. It is not something like a cold or a rash that, you know, clears up until it's gone. It's much more like waves and like the ebb and flow of the tide. The waves are enormous and frequent at first. Yes, the frequency diminishes and the size diminishes, but it is also true that when you least expect it, when your back is turned, you can be slammed, pulverized by a rogue wave that seems to come from nowhere. And the next thing you know, you're upside down, spinning and thrashing and gasping for air. That's grief.
Yeah, totally.
And what I learned to extend this wave metaphor further is that you really have two choices when there's an enormous wave coming at you, expected or unexpected. And that is, you either can try and stand up against it, you know, take it chest forward and stand up against it, in which case 99 out of 100 times, you're gonna end up upside down, thrashing and gasping.
Yeah.
Or you can lie down let it wash over you and float with it until you can stand up again. And I have learned for myself and for others to counsel the latter.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes, make peace with it. Float with it. And when you're ready, stand up again.
Yeah.
That's grief. So that's one very, very important change. You know, I used to say to people who were suffering in the early stages, you know, even at the cemetery, I would turn to you and say, Brooke, the only truthful and helpful thing I can say to you right now is it won't always hurt so much. I don't say that anymore. What I say now is, Brooke, it won't always hurt so often.
Mm-hmm.
Because the truth is, when it hurts every bit as much.
Yeah.
But it is also true, and I think hopeful and comforting, that it doesn't always hurt so often. And that's the difference between 99% truth and 100% truth. I've changed that.
That little nuance. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's one of the ways in which my work as a rabbi has been informed. The other thing, which maybe seems so obvious, but it's not really so obvious to people when they're in the midst of it,
mm-hmm.
which is people, I have found now, you know, you were saying earlier about how unexpected these things are, even when they're expected. And one of the things for people who have loved ones that are suffering from any form of dementia is they're surprised when the person physically dies, how just broken they are by it.
Yeah.
When in fact the person's been essentially gone for 5 years or more. And what I say to people now is, people with these kinds of diseases, they die twice. They don't die once, they die twice. I lost my father twice.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into this experience expecting it not to hurt very much the second time, because you've already experienced all the pain of losing this person. But the truth is, it hurts even more in some ways, because you're grieving both deaths at the same time. You're grieving all of that prior loss of the person, and you're grieving the physical loss of that person. So that's another insight I've been able to really help people with. And the other thing I will tell you is that I never understood, when I was walking a family into the chapel for a service, I understood how I felt as the rabbi doing that. Mm-hmm. I never understood how they felt as the mourners doing that. And now I do. And so I walk a family in differently. I say something different than I would have said before. You know what I say now?
What?
Now I say to them, Brooke, I wish I had something brilliant to say to you right now that would make this all better, but I don't. This is one of those days where you're just going to put one foot in front of the other until it's over. And we're going to get through it. Take my hand and let's go. Because that is the simple, unvarnished truth of it.
Right. And that means, I think, so much to a mourner. I remember after my dad died, my cousin, who had lost their mom as a teenager, reached out to me and was like, this is just going to be really, really bad. And there's nothing anyone's going to say that's going to make you feel better. And them saying that made me feel better.
Right. It validated how you were feeling. They dialed into your reality and frequency. And, you know, as my attorney likes to say, it has the added benefit of being true.
Right. Yeah.
It's the truth. Okay. Yeah. So these are some of the ways that I engage differently in the process with people with a greater degree of nuance and sensitivity.
When you were talking about you grieve twice, do you think that part of that has to do that second time that you think you're prepared for and you're not, when they physically are no longer with us? Do you think part of it, and I just thought of this, is because it like gets at your identity of, oh, does that mean I'm not a daughter anymore? Does that mean I'm not a son anymore?
This is absolutely true. And I find that it is particularly true when our second parent dies.
Mm.
You know, it's almost like Einstein's theory of relativity. I will tell you, the difference between two parents alive to one parent alive is not as great as the difference between one parent alive and no parent alive. Because, and this is a difficult word, and I wouldn't use it necessarily in the moment, but between the two of us and your listeners, the truth is you're not an orphan when your first parent dies, but you are an orphan, and that's a tough word. You are an orphan when the second parent dies, and not only are you an orphan, but you move up a rung on the generational ladder of your family, which is also a very strange experience.
Yeah.
You know, I'm one of five kids. Our mother is still alive. But when she dies, you know, I know the five of us, we're going to look at each other and say, we're now the aunts and uncles we grew up with.
Yeah.
You know, we're Uncle Mort, and we're Uncle Max, and we're Auntie Betty, and we're Auntie Jean. Like, that's us now. And that's how our kids and grandchildren will see us. And look, the truth is this mostly happens when you're ready for it, whether you realize it or not, when you're ready to move up that rung, but clearly it happened to you far too young. There's no way to even position it as remotely fair or right or just. But I do think that adjustment, you know, is a difficult one, and it takes time. And this goes back to how important it is that you give people permission and freedom to know, as I often put it, there is no wrong way to grieve. It is so comforting to people when I can look them in the eye, when they come to me saying, am I okay? Am I normal? I feel so this, I feel so that, I don't feel this, I don't feel that. Fill in the blanks. For me to be able to look at people and truthfully with my own experience as well and say to them, Brooke, there is no wrong way to feel right now. You are okay. What you're feeling is the result of the fact that you're human, and that grief is always a reflection of love. We only grieve the loss of someone we love. I think that's the other thing I've been able to say to people with a greater degree of authenticity, is there's no wrong way to grieve. Now, because you're expert in this field, I don't mean if someone can't get out of bed and won't eat, okay, or is drinking or smoking weed, you know, endlessly and can't function. Yeah, that's a wrong way to grieve. That an intervention is required there. They need to get professional help. But generally speaking, there's no wrong way to grieve.
Well, there's no model for how to do it because people don't talk about it. So people often think they're doing it wrong.
Right. And there's no wrong way. And by the way, as we said kind of earlier, I didn't quite call it out this directly, but this stuff about stages of grief, I don't buy it.
I hate it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I don't want to pick on Elizabeth Kubler-Ross because it was so groundbreaking when she at least identified, I think of it more as a set of feelings than stages. Because they're interchangeable. It's not linear.
And you tap into the different stages, I think, at different times, depending on what's going on for you and what your experience is. And I loved your analogy about the water, and we can talk more offline about it. But part of the reason that the logo of the podcast is water is because I have similar feelings on it. But we want a process, and I think we want it to be over, which is why people like, well, there's these stages and then you'll be done. And then you'll be fine.
And it's not true.
No.
It's not true. And if it was true, what would that say about the depth of our love for that person who has died? Will I ever be finished with my feelings and memories of my father? I hope not. That's not my goal. My goal is for my life to be informed by them. My goal is for my life to be more beautiful because of it. My goal is not amnesia.
That's really, I like the way you said that. That dovetails really nicely into something that we wanted to talk about of, did the experience of losing your father change your feelings on legacy?
Well, it reconfirmed something I have learned over the years from writing so many eulogies,
mm-hmm.
right? And being in cemeteries so frequently, you know, I'm often in a cemetery 3, 4, 5 times a week. And one of the things that has always caught my attention in cemeteries is the almost complete uniformity of headstone inscriptions. They mm-hmm. almost all say the same thing. You know, there are a few outliers. There are some funny ones and there's some, you know, long ones, but generally speaking, by the way, remind me to tell you my favorite funny one in LA after I make
it. Okay. Okay.
But generally speaking, they're all the same, which mm-hmm. I find very beautiful and very instructive. What do I mean? Look at headstones. When you have to distill a person's life, a person's truth, down to 15 characters per line and 4 lines, that is an exercise in essentialism. Okay, that strips away a lot of nonsense. So what do we see? Let's start with what we don't see on headstones. Nobody's net worth, nobody's GPA, where they went to college, where their kids went to college, where their grandchildren went to college, nobody's business resume, what kind of car they drove, where their address, none of that. It all gets distilled down to the essence of the meaning of life itself, which is generally loving wife, mother, grandmother, mm-hmm. friend, period. It is the quality of our relationships. It's what life is about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's who we have, not what we have, that really ultimately defines our lives. And so your question about legacy, of course, is, when I sit with a family and do what rabbis call an intake meeting to prepare for a funeral, which is really me facilitating a storytelling couple of hours because it's so therapeutic for them. And of course, it helps me with what I need to construct a eulogy. What are the things that really bubble up to the surface? What are the things that matter? It's always the little things. You know, my dad worked with me in the garage to make a cage for my pet salamander. You know, my mom taught me how to make her biscuits. She held my hand when my heart was broken by a girl in 7th grade. You know, these seemingly small things are actually our legacies.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the big things. It's not. I've done a lot in my career. I've built buildings and done all kinds of stuff. That's not what my kids are going to talk about when the rabbi gathers them together for my funeral.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's not what they're going to talk about. My son's going to talk about fishing and hiking and camping with me, and so is my daughter. And they're going to talk about those few times when a few words of encouragement made a difference in their lives. They're going to talk about those 1 or 2 times when I came down hard on them and helped keep them on the right path. I hope they're going to talk about the loving relationship they were witness to as children between their parents, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are the things that matter. And so my father, now with more than 2.5 years now of perspective, and my father was a very complicated person. He was not an easy person. He was a complex person.
Yeah.
I find that even his flaws, none of those are on the headstone either, those things that consume so much of my energy and worry and therapy and all of that.
Yeah.
So I find that legacy is ultimately about the little things, not the big things. You know, whoever said don't sweat the small stuff, frankly, was an idiot. Because I know it was a great title and sold a lot of books, but in life, it's literally the small stuff that is life.
Right. Well, so, and it's the relationships we have.
That's it, period. It's we have, not what we have. You know, there's a piece in the book called Nobody Wants Your Crap. And now, let me explain that for a second. So I have a friend, her name was Deborah. She's a casting director here in LA, and her mother died in Florida. She went to Florida, came back, and I talked to her. I said, Deborah, what did you learn from your mother's death? She said, Steve, the first thing I learned is nobody wants your crap. Now, what did she mean? Her mother spent her life collecting things. Things.
Mm-hmm.
That literally no one, when it was all over,
wanted.
No one wanted her crap. Right? So it's very easy to lose sight of this. It's very easy to spend our lives in the pursuit of things. Working
it's
so
easier.
Hard to buy things. It is easier than relationships. It's a very astute point. Very astute. It is easier. But the way I put it in the book is it's like spending your life in pursuit of things that ultimately terminate at the cemetery. There are no things with you at the cemetery. Spending your life in pursuit of the material, I tell people, is like trying to eat a picture of food. Right? Right? You go to a restaurant, you don't eat the menu.
You eat the food.
Right. So it's very easy in life to be confused between a picture of what's nutritious and meaningful and what feeds your soul and what actually is meaningful and feeds your soul. And cemeteries teach that. Look, that's why I chose the title, The Beauty of What Remains, because this is what death does for us. It strips away all that nonsense.
If you let it.
If you let it. And it gives you a much clearer picture of what really matters and what doesn't.
I totally agree with you. It's these lessons that sometimes you want to just be able to learn, but we can't learn them until we experience it.
You know what? In my view, death is the great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, the only teacher. Just imagine a deathless life. Imagine a deathless life. What value would there be to it? What ambition? What striving? What anything?
Mm-hmm.
It would be literally a meaningless existence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kafka said the meaning of life is that it ends. He's right. He's right. Wallace said the beauty of a flower is that it fades. It's true. And so death can help us really appreciate the beauty, the real beauty in our lives that is very often hiding in plain sight.
Well, I think that for so many of us that death like shakes you, like loss shakes you to your core.
Yes.
And if you give yourself the time and the grace to let it rebuild your foundation, you can have that new outlook on your life.
That's right. Marsha McLuhan said, the Canadian philosopher Marsha McLuhan said, I don't know who discovered water, but it wasn't the fish. Isn't that great?
Yeah. Right?
So obviously what he means is that a fish is born in water, lives in water, and dies in water, and therefore has no understanding of its own situation. When does a fish discover water? When it's on the shore, you know, flopping around and gasping for air, that's when a fish wakes up to its previous life, its own blessed life. Well, death does that for us, the living. It is disruptive. It yanks us out of that reality so that we can reapproach that reality with some real perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really count my blessings now since my father's Alzheimer's. I appreciate memory and thought and I try to spend more time on the things that I think will stay forever in my children's hearts, not less time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to moderate my professional ambition in certain ways. So, you know, we're like fish in water. We don't know anything about life until we are confronted by death. And look what's happening during the pandemic. Only a global threat of death could create the kind of change that we're seeing right now happening in our society. Nothing else could have done that. And that's the upside of this terrible downside. You know, I'm not for a moment trying to dismiss the pain and suffering of the pandemic, but it's hell. But the point is, if we're gonna go through hell, let's not come out empty-handed. You know, let's learn something and let's change our lives as a result of what we learn.
Right, and I think about half the people are doing that.
That's a pretty good percentage.
Yeah. Before we move on, I want you to tell me the funny grave story.
So there's this very exclusive, of course, because it's LA. There's this very small, very exclusive cemetery in West Los Angeles. It's where a lot of stars, celebrities are buried. Marilyn Monroe is buried there. It's where Joe DiMaggio took the rose every day, and a lot of famous people buried there. And so there's a long row of celebrity graves, super famous people. And Rodney Dangerfield's is there too.
Mm-hmm.
And Rodney Dangerfield's headstone says, "There goes the neighborhood." Isn't that great?
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay. So I do want to talk a little bit about eulogies, because when we were speaking before we started recording, you said something that I thought was really lovely, that we write our own eulogies with how we live.
Yes.
And I think that ties into the conversation that we were just having.
It does. You know, people think the rabbi, the minister, the priest, the best friend, they write our eulogies. And it is not true.
Mm-hmm.
We write our own eulogies with the pen of our lives. And living that way, I do not perceive as a kind of dark or depressing way to live. I think it's an enlightened and powerful way to live. Sometimes people play games with clergy and they say, "What is the meaning of life?" That's like a question they love to ask rabbis and priests and ministers and imams and bishops. And so we all have to come up with an answer, because they're not kidding. They think we know. And my answer is, the meaning of life is to live as a good ancestor.
Mm.
You know, we don't think of ourselves as ancestors, but every one of us is an ancestor, just not yet.
Yeah, I've never thought of myself as an ancestor.
Exactly. Now, start thinking of yourself as an ancestor and wanting to live as a good ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
And it really changes the way you proceed through life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gives you a greater sense of purpose. I think you have it already from the little I know of you and your story and the time we've spent talking together. I think you are exploring that purpose now through this podcast. And I think it's one of the gifts of the very terrible and sad loss that you endure. You know, there's a line of cleaning products called Seventh Generation. I don't know if you've seen it.
I buy those.
Do you know where the name comes from?
No.
It comes from a quote from the law of the Great Iroquois Nation, Native American Iroquois tribe, which says, when the elders of the tribe deliberate, they must consider the effect of their decision on the seventh generation to follow. Think about that. What a powerful way to live.
Mm-hmm.
How is what I am about to do or not do going to have, what's the echo effect seven generations from now? How can I make decisions today that will assure I am being a good ancestor? I think that's a very meaningful way to live. And I try, look, I don't think seven generations ahead, to be honest with you. And by the way, that was written at a time when a generation was brief. People didn't live as long as they do now. But I really try to live in a way that will result in a very positive and beautiful echo effect when I am long gone. And I find that to be a meaningful way to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I want my kids to see that.
Yeah, and when you think about being a good role model, like, I mean, I don't have any kids, but I would imagine parents want to be obviously a good role model for their children, but we're all role models to all of us. Mm-hmm. And I think that we often don't take the time to sit down, or many people don't. I don't want to speak for everybody, but that you don't necessarily always say, what do you appreciate about someone? We, in our family, my cousins and I started doing this on birthdays. At birthday dinners, we'll go around the table and say, what do you love about each other? And my grandma and I have the same birthday, which was a few weeks ago. And I'm in this, thank you. I'm in the same town as her. So we went and we ate outside. And my stepdad's birthday is the day after the both of ours. And so we did it. And my grandma was like, who made this game up? And she was clearly very moved. But I think that we often wait until after someone dies to verbalize what they meant to us.
Yeah.
And wherever you can be more effusive and verbal about that makes a difference, because people, we all, I think, deep down somewhere live of what is our legacy going to be.
Yeah. And we want gratitude to be a part of that legacy, right? And expressing our gratitude. There's a guy named Martin Seligman, who was the father of positive psychology at Penn. And he prescribed something for his depressed patients that he called a gratitude visit, where he would, and I actually did a segment on the Today Show where we did a gratitude visit. So if your listeners want to Google it, they can find it and actually see what this really looks like. So here's how it goes down. Let's use you for an example. I would say, Brooke, I want you to choose someone in your life who's made a tremendous difference, who you're really grateful to, but you've never really expressed that gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I want you to write a 300-word gratitude statement to that person. I want you to call that person up and say you'd like to come visit, but don't say why. And when that person opens the door, I want you to walk in, sit down, and read your gratitude statement to that person. It is unbelievably moving for both parties. And when Seligman studied this, what he discovered was that 1 week, 1 month, and 1 year later, the patient was less depressed.
Wow.
So you are on to something with this sort of gratitude sharing. What do I love about you? What do I appreciate about you? You know, one of the things this pandemic has taught me is that no matter how much we have told our friends and family we love them, no matter how much we have hugged them,
it's not enough.
It's never enough.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. Whenever something really terrible happens, I always think and tell people, just like, tell everyone you love them. Like, all the time. Too much. Double. And my dad like made a joke about it when he was in hospice, because I kept just being like, I love you, because I wanted to be able to say it to him. And he's like, you keep saying that. I'm like, well.
Yeah, get used to it, buddy. Yeah.
Can you talk to us about your concept of an ethical will? Because I think that's really interesting. I'd love to explore that a little more.
Yeah, this goes back, as far as we know, to the 14th century. In Western Europe, Germany was where we think it started, is this Jewish custom of creating what is called an ethical will. So most people by a certain point in their lives have an estate plan. You know, they have a will by which they bequeath to their heirs their physical and material assets. Mm-hmm. So Jews have seven centuries at least, or six centuries at least, have been creating a parallel document, a complementary document called an ethical will, where we articulate and bequeath to our children, or if you don't have children, to your, you know, family and friends, nieces and nephews, the ethical values we want them to inherit. Mm-hmm. And I've written mine for our children. And by the way, it's bound with the copy of our material will, our estate plan. You cannot read one without reading the other. First of all, it's a very beautiful process to go through. It does not take nearly as long as you think. I wrote mine in 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Because all I had to do was write, Dear Aaron and Hannah. And the rest just poured out. And so I really, in the book, my ethical will is in the book as a model, as an example for others to follow in creating their own. But, you know, I wish that I had this from my parents. I wish I had my father's, and you probably wish you had yours. As much as we can summon their teachings, to really have it written out, you know, Dear Brooke, this is what I hope you will remember of my life and my values and how I lived and why I lived this way. And these are my hopes and my dreams for you. I think it's so important. And of course, you never know. You never know. Any one of us may have a life that ends unexpectedly. You know, there's so many things, like, you never know when is the last time you're ever going to nurse your baby? When does that end? When is the last time your daughter's ever going to let you give her a bath? You know,
yeah.
When is she going to kick you out of the bathroom? When is the last Little League game you're ever going to see your son at the plate for? You don't know. You don't really know when things are going to end. And an ethical will is a way of being sure that when they do end, whether predictably or unpredictably, your children have something more than just your stuff.
Because that's what we hold, like, to circle to our other conversation, that
yes,
no one writes collector on a headstone.
That's right. And it also, by the way, if you get into the discipline of reading your ethical will to your children on occasion, it can keep you on the right path. You know, you can ask yourself, am I really living according to these values I say matter to me? Am I in alignment? By the way, this is why politicians and celebrities get into trouble, because their professed values and their lived values turn out not to be the same.
I would say a lot of people who aren't even celebrities and politicians do that.
Yeah, we're phonies. To a certain degree, we're all actors, and we're all phonies. The question is, to what degree, and are you, and how aware are you of it, and can you, you know, remember when my kids were little, we would take them bowling. They put up those bumper guards. You know, the ethical will can kind of be bumper guards to kind of keep you generally
for your life.
Headed in the right direction. Yeah, it's a very, very powerful experience to write one.
If you can talk a little bit about how COVID has changed how we mourn.
Well, mostly not for the better, although there are some aspects of it that are better. Let's start with what people might not think is better, but I think actually is. They just don't quite know it. Right now, at least in Los Angeles, funerals are limited to 10 or fewer people, graveside only, distanced, masked, etc. And some people say to me, oh, there would have been hundreds of people here, to which I, in my mind, I don't say this, like, you have no idea how lucky you are. That's not the case today. Because being a mourner in front of hundreds of people is incredibly stressful. It adds a whole nother layer of complexity to the day, to your feelings, to the process. For me, the rabbi, now I'm producing a show. I'm not present at a funeral. I'm producing a show. You know, for hundreds of people and different speakers and the music and the this, all that's gone with COVID. And I think that's actually better. I mean, at the end of the day, who do we really want at our graveside other than a handful of people that really matter? So that part I think is better, although people don't feel that way necessarily because they haven't always had the prior experience of the show.
Right.
What's worse, of course, is I can't hug people. I can't put my arm around their shoulder and say, this is a day we're going to get through together. Walk with me. Let's go. They're not allowed to handle the casket, not allowed to shovel earth. You know, there's there's a lot of restrictions now that make, that do rob people. And I think the most terrible of which is, you know, there's a Jewish custom called Shiva, which is a Hebrew word that means seven, but it's the custom of spending 7 days at home surrounded by family and friends after a loss, and they take care of you. That is no longer possible. So we have these gatherings on Zoom where people are invited to share stories and memories, and that's partly good because, you know, your uncle in London can be there and your cousin in, you know, Jerusalem can be there, but it's terrible in the sense that you go from the cemetery back into isolation. And isolation is not generally good for people who are in that early stage of grief. They need to be surrounded, right? They need to be surrounded. They need to be cared for. They need the opportunity to tell stories and to hear stories and to eat and to cry and to laugh. And none of that is really possible. So that's the downside. I mean, you know, it's a little bit of upside and a lot of downside. But that's the reality of where we are. And there's frankly nothing any of us can do about it right now. So it has changed a little bit for the better and a lot for the worse.
Yeah. I can't, I hope I don't experience a loss during COVID, because like I have talked to many friends who've lost people and weren't able to say goodbye or.
Yes, that's sort of the dying process too. It's pretty terrible that you can't be, I mean, I'm saying goodbye to people on FaceTime. It's terrible. And there's just no two ways about it. Now, the question again is, Brooke, will we come out of this hell empty-handed and learn nothing? Or will we come out of this hell with a real commitment to expressing our love and affection for others? That's the question.
I hope that people do. If you want to really quickly, because we have been talking for quite a bit of time, tell the audience a little bit about your book and where to buy your book and where to find you online, all of that.
Okay, so the book again is called The Beauty of What Remains, How Our Greatest Fear Becomes Our Greatest Gift. And it really is about the many beautiful, powerful, and important ways death comes to teach us about living a more meaningful and more beautiful life. It's very much a book about life, right? Death is the counterpoint to life. I say death is life's mirror in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's published by Penguin Random House, came out January 5th, and you can get it at Amazon, you can go to your local bookstore, you can order it from your local bookstore. If you want to know more about me and sort of what I'm thinking and doing, you can follow me on Instagram. It's at Steve_Leader. And I have a website, steveleader.com, that needs a little work, but still there's something there if you want to look at it. And of course, you can always find me at Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, which is my day job.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to read your book, and I really enjoyed our conversation today. So
thank you
for making time.
I so appreciate the opportunity. And at the risk of sounding patronizing, and I do not mean to be, I just feel like I'm older enough than you to tell you this. I didn't know your dad, but I'm moved by how you have used that loss to make your own life more purposeful and more meaningful. And I can only imagine, as a dad with kids your age myself, what a great job he did and how extraordinarily proud he would be of how his legacy has informed your life going forward. So my admiration is very deep for you and what you're doing.
That is very kind. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. You can find us online at www.thegriefcoach.co and on social at the_griefcoach. If you liked what you heard today, please write us nice reviews only on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people who are looking for this type of content find us more easily. If you have not nice things to say, you can just email or DM those to me, and they don't need to be on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you soon.